I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, a two-parter dealing with the late Neil Sheehan of the New York Times. Sheehan passed away on January 7th and was known in his lifetime for his reporting on Vietnam and his involvement in the story of the Pentagon Papers, which blew the lid off many of the deceptions made by the United States government during the Vietnam War. First up, an in-depth conversation with Jim DiEugenio of the Kennedys and King website. Now, if you're unfamiliar, Kennedys and King is a website dealing primarily with the assassinations of the 1960s. I myself have really not broached the topic of, say, the John F. Kennedy assassination, because it's not my area of expertise. And some rabbit holes just seem like they can become a quagmire of speculation. But if there was a website that I found interesting when it comes to assassinations like that of JFK, it's most undoubtedly Kennedys and King. Especially because its scope is broader than those assassinations themselves. Which is to say that the website features a number of fascinating essays related to the Vietnam War era, and one of those essays is what we will be talking about today with Jim DiEugenio, author of the piece, Neil Sheehan, A Retrospective. Jim offers a very different view of Sheehan and Sheehan's criticisms of the Vietnam War in that essay and the following conversation. I think if you're interested in history, the role of journalism in shaping our historical narratives, and how it all relates to our current moment, you will find this conversation to be of interest. And now, on to the discussion with Jim DiEugenio of Kennedys and King. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Jim DiEugenio of Kennedys and King, a really great resource on the Kennedy assassination and the Kennedy era in general. How are you doing, Jim?
Okay, how you doing? Fine.
Pretty good, pretty good. I wanted to have you back on the show, of course, because of the article you have on Neil Sheehan, who passed away, was very well known during the Vietnam era, plays a role in the Pentagon Papers story. He unfortunately passed away on January 7th, the day after the riots, so his passing sort of went under the radar. The New York Times published an obituary. You offered a retrospective that was much less fawning than the New York Times obituary. For my listeners that are unfamiliar, who was Neil Sheehan?
Well, Neil Sheehan was a journalist who had graduated from Harvard, spent some time in the military, then went to work for UPI in Tokyo, became their Vietnam correspondent. When he went to Vietnam, he met David Halberstam of the Times, of the New York Times, and he eventually switched over to the New York Times, and he worked with the Times for many years afterward, all right? And after that, he became a writer of books, the most famous one being A Bright Shining Lie about the life of Colonel John Paul Vann, who he and Halberstam had very much come under the influence of in Vietnam in 1962 and 1963.
Halberstam even wrote a book about it, right? The Best and the Brightest?
Well, that's not really about John Paul Vann, okay, although he figures in it, all right? His other book, The Making of a Quagmire, which he tried to forget, that's the one that really deals with John Paul Vann. All right, he wrote that in 1965. Now, Vann was very, to say that they were adulatory about Vann is not exaggerating at all. Now, the interesting thing, though, is why they were adulatory about Vann, okay? Because John Paul Vann was very critical of the way the Vietnam War was being fought in those early years, all right? And he thought that the approach was wrong, all right? And that if we changed our approach, that we could probably win the war. But Vann said that could not happen unless you had direct American intervention, all right? So if you read Halberstam's book, The Making of a Quagmire, that's what he's asking for. We have to get in faster, come in stronger, with more firepower, okay? Now, why is that so interesting? Because his big bestseller in 1973, he barely mentions any of that. He wants you to make you forget that he had been a hawk. This was it. He and Sheehan were hawks. They really wanted to win the war, okay? Whereas at this time, 62 and 63, Kennedy's trying to get out of the war, okay? He has sent McNamara, he has sent John Kenneth Galbraith, the ambassador to India, to go see McNamara in Washington, giving him a report, advising him to de-escalate the war, all right? And so then, that's in April of 1962. 1 month later, McNamara goes over to this big meeting in Saigon. He tells the general in charge of the war, Paul Harkins, to stay after a minute, all right? And at his little meeting with Harkins, he says, we're not here to fight the war for the South Vietnamese. Only the South Vietnamese can fight the war for themselves. We're here to train them. We're here to advise them. We're here to give them equipment, okay? But we're not going to fight the war for them. So I want you to go ahead and start making withdrawal schedules for every aspect of our military personnel in country. And I want you to have them as soon as you can because we're getting out, all right? So now you have Kennedy trying to get out of the war. But you have Halberstam and Sheehan in their articles talking about how badly the war is being fought. And this information is being given to them by John Paul Vann. Because John Paul Vann is working at cross currents with both Kennedy, Sheehan, and Halberstam. All right. So it made for a very interesting and complex situation. All right. And if you read The Best and the Brightest, which I think sold something like 1.8 million copies, all right, you won't see hardly anything about Kennedy withdrawing from the war, all right? And in fact, that book, which I think was published in 1973, actually began the whole, drum roll of it being McNamara's war, blaming the war on Robert McNamara.
McNamara, for younger listeners, was the Secretary of Defense.
Right, the Secretary of Defense under Kennedy. 61 to 68. Mm-hmm. Who stayed under Johnson also until he resigned, I think, in either late 67 or early 68. All right. Now, by the way, and I have to say this also. In 1973, in The Best and the Brightest, what's so interesting about that book that Halberstam wrote is that if you recall, and I'm sure your listeners recall this, the way the United States got into the Vietnam War was because we backed the French in their war to retake the country after World War II. By 1950, 51, 52, 53, the United States was supplying something like 80% of the budget for France to fight the war, all right? Then in 1954, at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the French were decisively defeated, all right? The United States slowly but surely then did two things that got us into that war. Number one, we created a new country. See, this is what people forget. There was no country of South Vietnam, okay, at the end of the first Vietnam War with the French. We created this country of South Vietnam. Then we broke the Geneva Accords, all right, which was supposed to be allow for a unification election, okay, after the war, all right, in 1956. In the meantime, we had propped up our leader, Ngo Dinh Diem, all right, and we told him not to sponsor those elections. This is how we got into this war. That's how we got in. Now, if you read Halberstam's book, which I think is something like over 700 pages long, you know how many pages he spends on this? About two. Okay? When, in my opinion, it's the most crucial part of what happened, all right? He spends over 300 pages talking about Kennedy and only a few more talking about Johnson. Now, on the other end, everyone knows that the war completely changed once Johnson became president, okay? He did what Kennedy was never going to do, which was commit combat troops into Vietnam. And it's the same thing with Neil Sheehan in his book, A Bright Shining Lie. He blames the war on Kennedy. All right. You know, he says it was John Kennedy who committed the United States arms to fight a communist regime in Vietnam. All right. And it's peppered like that throughout the book. You know, so after reading the literature about Sheehan, about Halberstam, and understanding, due to declassified documents, what really happened, is I came to a contrary conclusion about Sheehan and Halberstam. I came to the conclusion that what they were really doing was not really journalism. What they were doing was CYA.
Covering okay. Your ass.
Right. And so in the process, they decided to go ahead and blacken Kennedy, okay, so they wouldn't look so bad. Because here you have these two guys, Halber, and remember, and this is another thing that's very bothersome to me. These guys were supposed to be reporters. In other words, what a reporter is supposed to do, what a journalist is supposed to do, is to render a kind of day-by-day journal honestly depicting what is happening on the scene and not to take sides one way or the other. You're supposed to be, as they say, objective. But if you look at what these guys were going on helicopter missions. They were dressed up in these military outfits. The picture I have in my article at KennedysandKing.com, you'll see Halberstam and Sheehan are standing outside of a helicopter, ready to get on board with big grins on their faces. They find this fun, you know, all right? And so instead of neutrally deciphering the situation, they essentially, and I don't mind saying this at all, and I wrote it in my article, okay? They essentially wanted to kick commie butt. That's how they looked at the war. Now, if you oppose that to what Kennedy was doing, as I wrote in the article, Kennedy had a much more sophisticated view of what was going on in Vietnam, all right? Because he had been there in 1951. And he had this famous meeting with Edmund Gullion, who was one of the diplomats at the American embassy there. Okay. And Edmund Gullion had told him, France is not going to win this war. In 20 years, there will be no colonies. All right. Ho Chi Minh has fired up these people to the point they would rather die than go back under the yoke of colonialism. If we take over, the same thing will happen to us as what happened to the French.
If I could, real briefly here, interject. I think that in a way, you're really pushing back even more broadly on a lot of the views that have started permeating the culture, just about Kennedy in general, because I think, you know, there's this narrative we see in the mainstream media and even on the right with people like Rush Limbaugh, who want to portray Kennedy as just merely another Cold War hawk. I think Limbaugh even said once, oh, Kennedy would have been a ditto head like me. You're arguing that. Yeah, right.
He said
right?
that? He really said
yes,
that?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So if we could, maybe we can delve deeper into the sort of view of Kennedy as a Cold War hawk.
No, it's not the case at all. See, Kennedy, after he had visited Saigon in 1951, that meeting with Gullion, because his brother was with him, he went with his brother and his sister Patricia. Bobby later said that that meeting had a very, very deep impact on my brother's thinking. All right. And so he then began to write, do radio shows, okay, and do interviews talking about how the United States should not ramp up support for France. All right. We shouldn't be backing what is essentially a colonial war. And he actually said words to the effect, this is not really about democracy versus communism. This is really about colonialism versus nationalism and independence. And we're going to be on the wrong side, okay? Because the nationalists are going to win, you know? He actually began to talk like that, all right? And then let me explain this, because it's a very, very important step, and it really shows a difference between Kennedy and Nixon. Nixon, of course, was the vice president in 1954. During the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, and on the eve of Dien Bien Phu, the climactic battle of the French-Vietnamese colonial war, John Foster Dulles put together an operation called Vulture. Vulture was a massive air armada, which included, I might have this wrong, but I'm going to be pretty close, 150 fighter planes, 60 conventional bombers, and three, I think, conveyors that would carry one atomic bomb each. This is what John Foster Dulles wanted to use to bail out the French siege at Dien Bien Phu. Nixon was his megaphone in Congress trying to get support for it. When Kennedy heard about this, okay, he went to the Senate floor and said, no amount of arms, no amount of men, no amount of money, no amount of bombing is going to win this war for us. We're fighting an enemy that is everywhere and nowhere. An enemy that's supposed to be against the people, but who the people shelter themselves. Okay, so he's trying to say, this: what are you using atomic bombs for in a guerrilla war? This makes no sense at all, you know, all right? And so this really was a point of departure for him against, and not just the Republican establishment, but the Democratic establishment. Because it was really Dean Acheson and Truman who started the aid to France, Okay, it ramped up during Dulles. So after this, after Dien Bien Phu fell, Kennedy really wanted to know what Eisenhower and Dulles were going to do, because he was worried that what Gullion said was going to happen. We're going to end up taking the place of France. Okay? And so he wrote a letter to John Foster Dulles, all right, on this point. You know, and Dulles never answered the letter, all right? But he saw what was happening, that the United States was now going ahead and getting into this situation, propping up this new country called South Vietnam, all right? And he said, look, the only way this is going to work is if we build a real democracy there, okay? If we build something that will win the allegiance of the people, all right? Well, everyone knows that isn't what happened, okay? The CIA under Allen Dulles sent in Colonel Ed Lansdale, and Ed Lansdale began to build what was really a fascist regime under Ngo Dinh Diem. So Kennedy now begins to really open up on Eisenhower, the Dulles brothers, and Nixon. And this is climaxed by his famous 1957 Algeria speech, where, again, France is trying to maintain a colonial empire, this time on the north coast of Africa called Algeria. June the 2nd, 1957, Kennedy takes the floor of the Senate. And he just lambastes the administration. And he says words to the effect, how dumb can we be? How did we forget just 3 years ago we did the same thing in Vietnam and France fell? We want to do the same thing now in Algeria in a war that France cannot win, and we're going to back them again? He said, we should be doing two things. Number one, getting France to negotiate a way out, all right? And two, freeing the colonial states in Africa.
If I could, I want to interject. I was recently reading a book called The Jakarta Method by Vincent Bevins, and it has to do with Indonesia. It ties into Greg Pulgrain's work, actually, JFK versus Allen Dulles, Battleground Indonesia. And it's really interesting because you do have these figures like Howard P. Jones, who was in the CIA at the time, saying, you know, I don't think we need to look at the Third World Movement and say, oh, they're part of the communist menace. And my understanding is that Kennedy also came to that same view that, you know, the Third World Movements are not, you know, our enemies necessarily.
Right. That is a conclusion he came to. And he wanted to, what Kennedy wanted to do is essentially have a neutralist foreign policy, okay? And this would allow these emerging countries coming out of the colonial situation to go ahead and pick and choose who they wanted to cooperate with and what kind of government they wanted to have, all right? And Kennedy thought that if we automatically sided with the European powers, okay, then that was actually going to send the wrong message. It would favor the Russians, all right? It would make the Russians look like the good guys. All right? So he said, what I want to do is I want to compete with the Russians. I want to show these leaders that we can be as friendly as they can be, and we have more to offer. All right. And that's the way we'll win them over. Okay. All right. By the way, I didn't think very much of the Bevins book. I reviewed it on my website. All right. But that the whole thing about the non-aligned movement was very important. And Dulles hated the non-aligned movement. Kennedy favored the non-aligned movement. All right. He told George Ball, you know, words to the effect, you know, that what we have to do is we have to be competitive, okay? And it's not going to be by force of arms. You know, we have to be willing to give money, to give food, okay, to give supplies, to build infrastructure, okay, in order to get those emerging countries out of all the pernicious damage that eons of colonialism had done, right? So, see, Kennedy had a much more sophisticated view of Vietnam than Sheehan did and that Halberstam did. Like in my article at Kenny's and King, I said, in 62 and 63, Sheehan and Halberstam might as well have been acting in the John Wayne movie, The Green Berets, you know, because that's how propagandistic and that's how ignorant, I don't mind you using that because they were, how ignorant they were about how complex the situation was, you know. And so Kennedy understood this, all right, and he was trying to get out, whereas those two guys wanted to ramp it up. And under this great leadership of John Paul Vann, they were going to go ahead and win the war, which can't, and to show you how ignorant this is. In 1963, after Kennedy had turned aside every single attempt to bring combat troops into Vietnam, and he did it about nine different times, all right, he told Mike Forrestal, of the National Security Council, he said, look, we have about a 1 in 100 chance of winning in Vietnam, all right? He goes, when I get back from Dallas, all right, we're going to have a general overall review of how we got there, what we thought we were doing, and if we should be there at all. Of course, that meeting never happened. Okay, because of what happened in Dallas, all right? But see, that's how sophisticated Kennedy was about the situation, all right?
He didn't have this sort of black and white view that I would argue, you know, a John Foster Dulles had, where it's, you know, it's us versus, you know, the commies everywhere, the commies right under our bed, yeah.
Yes, and that's the way Dulles looked at it. See, for John Foster Dulles, there was no such thing as neutralism in the Cold War. To him, neutralism was one step away from communism. All right. Now, Sheehan and Halberstam at this time were essentially the John Foster Dulles view. Okay. That's the way they looked at it, you know. And they, all this stuff about the domino theory and the communist monolith and all that kind of stuff, you know, that they believe this stuff.
For younger listeners, maybe you could just, I mean, I think people understand just by the title of it, but for some listeners, what is the domino theory?
The domino theory was announced by Dwight Eisenhower in 1954. All right. He made a speech in which he said, if we let Vietnam fall, okay, then this will create a chain reaction that will then lead to the rest of Southeast Asia, to Indonesia, to the Philippines. He had the dominoes falling all the way to San Francisco, okay, you know, across the Pacific, all right, because he believed that it was this communist monolith, okay, ignoring the fact that when China fell in 1949, it fell by itself. There was no domino, okay, theory there, all right? But these guys believed in this stuff, all right? Well, you know something? I really have to take that back because in my opinion, I don't think they really believed it. I think they used it just for propagandistic purposes, you know, and to put the – and Nixon was as bad as all of them, all right? Nixon, I mean, if you can believe this, Nixon not only was there at the beginning when we overthrew the Geneva Accords – in 1954. He was all the way there until the end in 1975. Okay. You know, he didn't want to get out in the 1970s. He invaded Cambodia, invaded Laos, tried to extend the war in order to get some kind of Korean settlement, you know, which was not going to happen. The North Vietnamese were not going to accept any kind of settlement this time around.
Now, I want to note that this article is heavily footnoted. You have a lot of sources that you cite. And one of those sources is actually an interview with Sheehan, I believe, from 2007. Why did that figure so prominently into the article? What did you find so insightful about it?
See, that interview that I found in 2007, it was the first time that either one of those guys, either Sheehan or Halberstam, actually confessed that they were in the hands of the Cold War in 1962 and 1963.
And especially through Van and his sort of view of things.
Right. That somehow the United States had to win. You know, that if we didn't win, that somehow it would be a fatal moment in history. You know, that the dominoes would fall, that the communist monolith would advance, you know, etc. And I that was the first time I'd ever seen either one of them actually admit that, okay, that they were that indoctrinated into this whole Cold War propaganda that John Foster Dulles, his brother Alan, and Nixon had tried to put out about how important Vietnam was. And see, this is another difference. See, Kennedy's worldview, he just didn't see Vietnam as being that important to our national security, you know, all right? That's why he said, look, we can help them. We can give them advice. We can send in advisors. We can give them equipment. But it's just not that important to us, okay? It's, what, 6,000 miles away. You know, how is that going to threaten our national security? How are the farmers and the peasants and the cows and the horses and all that? How is that going to impact our national security? You know? And so he just didn't see that as a place, you know, that to put everything on the line for. Whereas someplace like Berlin, he did see that as very important. To him, Berlin was a very, very important place because that was the basis of NATO. You know, if we couldn't let the communists take over West Berlin, because that would weaken the NATO alliance. All right. So, but Vietnam, he just didn't see it as being that important, whereas Johnson did.
Now, in regards to both Halberstam and Sheehan, you know, I think in particular, I've read The Best and the Brightest. A lot of people cite it as a book about elite failure occurring. How would you portray these two books, and in particular the Sheehan book? Because I feel like Sheehan leaves things out, as you point out in your own article.
All right. The Best and the Brightest, the best description I've ever seen of that was by Warren Hinkle, the late editor of Ramparts. He called it one of the greatest bullshit books ever written. And I agree with them. All right. It's one of the greatest bullshit books ever written. It's very long, about 700 pages. And it's so much filler. If you cut out all the biographies he puts in there, because he puts in biographies about every other chapter of people who are not even related to the subject matter. If you cut out all the biographical stuff, it'd be about 300 pages long. And he wouldn't have very much to say at all. Okay, it's a very pretentious, bloated, you know, kind of pompous look at the war. And if you tried to extract what's really important from the book, what has lasting influence, you might come up with at most 15 pages. Okay, and that's exaggerating. Now, A Bright Shining Light. Sheehan spent 13 years writing this book, okay? And it was about John Paul Van, Colonel John Paul Van. John Paul Van was a guy he met. He and Halberstam met in 1962 in Vietnam. And he was complaining bitterly about how we were fighting the Vietnam War. Okay. Van thought that we had to fight it smarter, that we had to try and be more friendly with the South Vietnamese, okay, that we had to use, you know, differing tactics of the tactics we were using, all right? And he complained bitterly about the ARVN. That was the Army of South Vietnam. He said, these guys cannot win the war, which is absolutely true. The ARVN, and the proof of that, of course, is once the United States got out, and it was just the ARVN against North Vietnamese regulars, South Vietnam fell in 4 months, okay, in 1975. All right. So that's why he said we had to take on more and more and more of the weight of the war. Okay. See, and this is the worst thing, I believe, about what Sheehan did back then, and even in A Bright Shining Line. I believe that Halberstam, in his 1965 book, The Making of a Quagmire, and Sheehan, in his writings about the war, even up to A Bright Shining Line, they created what I call the lost cause. Now, the lost cause is usually applied to the Civil War, okay? You know, that somehow that the South believed in this aristocratic and effete and educated way of life, all right? And it really wasn't all that bad, okay? Now, they did this with Vietnam, that the United States could have won the war, that Van was the guy who should have replaced Harkins. And if he would have, we would have won the war, and somehow that would have been good. Okay, see, I cannot disagree with that more. And even I think A Bright Shining Line is 1986, even in that book, he still tries to hold up Van as some kind of military example by saying that Van, in that interview I talked about, he literally said that Van stopped the Easter Offensive in the spring of 1972. I couldn't believe this when he said that. Okay. Van helped win the Battle of Con Tom, which was one battle in a 6-month offensive. It was a tremendous tank and infantry attack in which General Giap tried to win the war. The only way we stopped the Easter Offensive was when Nixon called out what's called Operation Linebacker, which was, up to that time, the heaviest bombing done in Vietnam up until the Christmas bombing, which was about 7 months later. It was a tremendous jet fighter, jet bomber attack. That's what stopped the Easter Offensive. For Sheehan to say, see, because he's still trying to say that, well, see, if Van would have been in charge, we might have won. You know? Which I think is utterly ridiculous. Because besides the whole military aspect, which we could not have won, we could not have won militarily, okay? In my opinion, Kennedy had the right idea. We should have gotten out in 65, okay? We should, because then what would have happened there now would have happened much earlier. If you take a look at pictures of Vietnam online in the internet, okay? You know what they have, especially in the southern part of the city? They have Ben and Jerry's, Bank of America, McDonald's, Domino's. Okay, so we did win, okay? We didn't have to spend all those dead people, you know, the casualty rate was just tremendous.
Now, in regards to what's left out, my understanding is, in A Bright Shining Lie, you know, Eisenhower's role is sort of minimized. There's a lot of focus on Kennedy, not much mention of RFK's antagonism towards the war. Could you get into that a little bit? And then we'll shift to Sheehan and the Pentagon Papers.
Sheehan actually does the same thing that Halberstam did in The Best and the Brightest. He puts the onus of the war, the blame for the war, essentially on John F. Kennedy. All right. Kennedy was just inheriting a horrendous situation, all right? And he was getting it from Eisenhower and Nixon and John Foster Dulles. They're the ones who committed us to this war of this new country, South Vietnam, that never existed before. All right. And so he left them in a pretty bad situation with this very unpopular leader, Ngo Dinh Diem. There had already been coup attempts against Ngo Dinh Diem. All Kennedy did is he raised a number of advisors and he sent them more equipment. But within 5 months of that, that's called NSAM 111, which was passed, I think, in November of 1961. Within 5 months of that, he has Galbraith, as I said earlier, going to see Robert McNamara to begin the withdrawal program because Galbraith said, this is not going to work. Okay. And Kennedy had a very special relationship with the ambassador to India, John Kenneth Galbraith. He had been his tutor at Harvard back in the 30s.
And this isn't really in a bright, shining lie, any of this. It's not really mentioned.
It's not even in the best and the brightest. It's not, you know, if I remember correctly, they mention it in passing. You know, it's like a sentence or two, when in fact, it's the most important thing that happened in the Kennedy administration. He also leaves out Robert Kennedy's very much antagonistic relationship with Johnson over the war. See, in 1964, as he was leaving, Robert Kennedy had a meeting with Johnson in which he told him, words to the effect, I would strongly recommend that you not escalate in Vietnam. All right, because he knew what his brother was doing. All right, he was getting out. All right, then he told Arthur Schlesinger about that conversation. And he said, I don't think Johnson's going to listen to me because I think he's going to listen to Eisenhower. And Eisenhower doesn't want us to get out. Well, this gets back to Halberstam. And Halberstam starts writing, who does Robert Kennedy think he is? Does he really think he knows more about making war than Dwight Eisenhower? Does he really think he knows more than Lyndon Johnson? We need more bombing. We need more firepower. Okay. This is 64. This is 1964. All right. And so these guys ignore all this in their books. All right. And like I said, I believe it's a process of CYA. I really believe that, you know, because look, you can say, well, look, Halberstam's book came out in 1973. You can say Sheehan's book came out in 1986. And you can say, well, you know, they probably... Peter Dale Scott in 1971 wrote an essay in Ramparts in which, in his very close study of the Pentagon Papers, said, wait a minute, there's evidence in here that Kennedy was trying to get out. And there was, especially in the Mike Gravel edition, which was longer than the New York Times edition, there was a section called phase withdrawal. It was 40 pages long, in which they discussed the McNamara-Kennedy plan to get out. All right? So I'm sorry. I don't buy this, that these guys were unaware of this at all. I don't believe it. It was in the Pentagon Papers. It was in Ramparts magazine. You know, so I don't believe that they were unaware of this. I believe they ignored it deliberately.
Now, I want to reiterate, what's really important for me is, you know, you basically do the step-by-step here that is really left out of the Halberstam book, which is, one, Galbraith visiting Kennedy, two, Galbraith seeing McNamara, and then you get to McNamara ordering Harkins to begin the dismantling of the American mission, and then, four, the withdrawal schedules being presented to McNamara. You know, this is like the smoking gun, essentially. Well, Kennedy had a different view. Yeah.
I don't believe it can be any more clear than that. Okay. Especially when Harkins, this is what, if you read Jim Douglas's book, when McNamara told Harkins to repair withdrawal plan, the other guy was there said, you should have seen the expression on Harkins' face. His jaw dropped about 4 inches, you know, because it was such a surprise out of left field. All right. Now, Why do I not buy the fact that these guys didn't know about this? If you spend 13 years writing a book, which is what Sheehan did with A Bright Shining Lie, if you interview 500 people, like Halberstam claims he did, if you have access to the Pentagon Papers, okay, like they both did, I don't believe that you can miss this stuff. I just have a very hard time buying that. And in fact, let me say something I didn't say in the article. When I was doing the research for Oliver Stone's documentary on JFK, I found an oral interview and a written interview with Halberstam. In the written interview, he admitted that he was doing a reaction against what he considered the hagiographies of Kennedy that had come out. You know, books like Schlesinger's and Sorensen's and Pierre Salinger's and Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers. He admitted that he part of the reason for the book was for that, to react against that. Then, when Oliver Stone's film came out, they did an interview with Halberstam. All right, this was 1991, 1992. Halberstam actually said that there was no military kind of plot to escalate the Vietnam War. I almost fell off my chair, okay? Because not only was there, he was a part of it. Halberstam was a part of it. He was pushing John Paul Vann, okay? He was pushing John Paul Vann to take over the war in order to escalate the war. John Paul Vann actually went to the Pentagon. He wanted to brief the Joint Chiefs of Staff on his plan to escalate the war. At the last minute, that meeting was called off. Now, let me say that what I'm about to say I know is speculation and I can't prove. I believe that McNamara got wind of this meeting and he's the one who canceled the meeting. Now, what I base that on, Kennedy wanted Halberstam rotated out of Saigon. He wanted him rotated out of Saigon because of his advocacy for an expanded war and an escalated war. The New York Times would not rotate him out. Okay. All right. That's why I believe McNamara canceled that meeting.
It sounds like all of this was part of like a mini war going on in Washington over how to approach Vietnam. There's one approach that says maybe we should be diplomatic, treat the third world movements or non-aligned movements as neutral. And then there's the other side that sort of just wants to escalate the conflicts.
Yes, yes. See, and the thing is, Kennedy understood that there wasn't a military solution to this thing. You know, it wasn't. And he actually said this to Schlesinger. He said, look, if we fight the war for them, it will turn into a white man's war. Okay? Not their war. It'll be our war. It'll be a white man's war. And the same thing that happened to France will happen to us. So that's why, you know, we have to keep it their war. All right? And see, what he meant by that was that if it became a white man's war, that would even more overtly suggest that it was a colonial war. Okay? That
and as you said earlier, you know, that they were throwing off the yoke of colonialism.
Right, exactly. All right? And so that would brand it more as a colonial war. And that's how he understood it from his visit there, you know, in 1951. And this is what these guys, they just didn't comprehend it, at least at that time. They didn't comprehend it. I actually believe, and I don't think I'm overstating this by very much, I believe that Neil Sheehan and David Halberstam looked at this sort of like the Rudyard Kipling point of view. It was a white man's burden, you know, to bring civilization, you know, and progress. you know, to Vietnam. I believe that it was tinged with some of that, all right? And the fact that they were so wrong, they were disastrously wrong, I think that they wanted to cover up just how wrong they were, because they did get their wish. They did get their wish. What they wanted happened. American intervention in the war. And it ended up being, just as Kennedy said, a disaster. Okay? The total casualties, and actually let me revise that. The total death count today for America and Vietnam is 3.8 million. Let me say that again. 3.8 million. All right. Now, in my opinion, you have to add Cambodia into that, because it was Richard Nixon who decided to invade Cambodia. All right. And if you recall, that was 1972. This caused the eventual collapse of the Sihanouk regime, the collapse of Lon Nol, and the rise of Pol Pot. And the Khmer Rouge ended up taking about 2 million lives. And those were the radical, you know, anarchist, syndicalist, you know, party in Cambodia, wanted to rebuild the whole civilization of Cambodia and start over.
Do you think, too, that Sheehan and Halberstam fit into, like, maybe a broader sort of establishment view of the Vietnam era, where, you know, if we would have had the right people, it would have gone differently? You know, ultimately, I'm not sure that a lot of these establishment media types really question the war entirely. A lot of it is like, well, we didn't have the right technocrats there.
Yes. I think that that's a, see, there's actually been a series of books on this, which I talked about in my article, the latest being Max Boot, The Path Not Taken. That was, I think, just a year ago.
And that was the one about Lansdale.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. And that is a lost cause book. It's essentially saying that what we did in Vietnam really wasn't that bad. And if you remember, Ronald Reagan said this. Ronald Reagan said this at a speech, that it was a noble cause, us to be fighting in Vietnam. And that's what Max Boot is saying, that it was really, we had our hearts in the right place, you know, and if we would have been just a little bit smarter and let somebody like Lansdale, who, by the way, was John Paul Van's hero, okay? I mean, right there, you got a problem, as far as I'm concerned. If Ed Lansdale's your hero, I don't want to be associated with you. Okay. All right. And so this is what I mean about what Sheehan and Halberstam did, is that they helped create this lost cause mythology, you know, that America was really there for the right reasons. If we had misdirection, you know, it was a technique, it was a methodology, but we were there for all the right reasons. What those reasons were, I will never know. Okay, what we were doing in Vietnam. And Kennedy said he didn't know either. He said, this is what we're going to talk about when I get back from Dallas. All right.
So I want to move back to the Pentagon Papers, and we'll get into the Mark Lane story in a bit. But the Pentagon Papers, how would you describe that? To, like I said, I have a few younger listeners that may just be learning some of the history. It was a study commissioned in secret by Robert McNamara.
The Pentagon Papers in itself is a tremendous story. And you have to go back, I believe, to the relationship between Kennedy and McNamara. By the end of 1966, when Johnson has escalated the war to things that Kennedy would never even imagine doing. Okay, Operation Rolling Thunder, which was, I think I'm getting this right, it was the greatest bombing campaign since World War II. We dropped more bombs over Vietnam than we dropped over Europe during World War II. All right? That was Operation Rolling Thunder. By late 1966, Johnson had committed something like 275,000 combat troops to Vietnam, which would eventually go up to over 500,000. Under Kennedy, there were none. Kennedy, that's where Kennedy drew the line. We're not going to have combat troops. We're not going to fight this war for them. All right. And McNamara, by late 1966, there was a meeting, a dinner between McNamara and some of the other former Kennedy guys who had dropped out of the Johnson administration at that time. And Galbraith was there. And he said, McNamara started weeping. You know, he's saying, I told Johnson, I told him, this rolling thunder is not going to work. You can't bomb a third world country into submission. It's not like Nazi Germany, where you have all these targets, or Japan. All right. What are you going to do? Bomb cows? Are you going to bomb windmills? You know, there just aren't that many industrial or communication targets, you know? And he said, and now he's got these combat troops in there, you know, and he doesn't listen to me. That was the beginning of the Pentagon Papers. Okay. McNamara got so discombobulated by this.
That he was willing to create a paper trail.
Right. He was so depressed. There were days that he would go into work and he would literally hide behind a curtain. Okay, because he was so distraught by this. And so he decided that the United States should never, ever do something like this again. All right. And so he was going to create a paper trail of all the lies and deceptions that had promulgated this war to the press, which he knew were false. Right. And it was a top secret project. Johnson didn't know. He deliberately didn't tell Johnson about it because he knew he would veto the idea. And so he put together a team led by Leslie Gelb in the Defense Department. And one of the guys working on it was Daniel Ellsberg. All right. And so, because Ellsberg had been in the Defense Department also. All right. So they put together this project that went on with, I think there was something like 30 people working on it, all right, supervised by Gelb, all right? And Mac, and Gelb said that whenever I needed access to something, McNamara would make a phone call, and I'd get it, all right? So when it was all over, everybody realized what a bombshell it was, because it essentially said that what was coming out of Washington as to what we were doing and what we were trying to do, et cetera, was not really the facts of what really happened, all right? And so Daniel Ellsberg, who had been in Vietnam from 65 to 67, and he'd been shown around by John Paul Dan, he had been there on an expedition under Lansdale, he had been for the war. But after he came back, he saw what a mess it was, and he now agreed. He now became a dove. There's no way in the world we're going to win this thing. So what are we doing there? You know, and so he copied the Pentagon Papers, or a large part of them. All right. He wanted to get them out to the public.
Right, because I mean these papers, they basically showed that D.C. had been lying to the American people.
And now, if you read the Pentagon Papers, there's two parts to them. What they will do is they'll take a certain time period and they'll have an opening narration. Okay. This is what the media said we were doing. This is what we were really doing. And then it has the documents there to back it up. You know, for example, we really weren't there to bring democracy to the public. Okay, what we're really there for is to avoid a humiliating American defeat. And one part of it actually says that. All right. Okay, and so Ellsberg copies these things. And what he wants to do is he wants to get them to a politician in Washington. Because if you're on the floor of the House or the Senate, you have legal immunity. Okay? And so all he had to do was get either a senator or a congressman to start reading from them, like, you know, 3 or 4 hours, and then say, I will admit the rest of this speech into the record. And then that would have gotten him off the hook. Okay. Well, he went to 4 people in Washington, and none of them would do it. George McGovern would not do it. Pete McCloskey would not do it. Bill Fulbright would not do it. And I think the other guy was Charles Mathias. Okay. None of them would do it for one reason or another. So then he's at wit's end, okay, and he decides to call Neil Sheehan because he met him in Vietnam, all right? At that time, Ellsberg had a teaching fellowship at, I think, MIT, all right? And so he was renting an apartment there. And so he was living in one apartment. He had rented another apartment to put the papers in, all right? And so he calls up Sheehan, all right? And he shows Sheehan the papers. He says, you can copy them a few pages. You can take some notes. But what I want from you is I want a commitment that the New York Times will print a large part of them and will play them up prominently, okay, like on the front page. There's no point in me giving these to you unless I have that commitment from you, all right? And I need it fast because the word will go, I'm telling you about this, you're going to tell somebody else about it, more people are going to know, and the FBI is going to be knocking at my door, okay, because it's classified, all right? Okay, and so Sheehan wasn't in a position to do that, okay? You know, to actually, because he was just a reporter. You know, he wasn't an editor. And by the way, that decision went all the way up to the publisher, Punch Sulzberger, all right? There was a big debate in the New York Times about whether or not to publish him. So Ellsberg left him the key, all right? Without giving him any assurance, Sheehan didn't give him any assurances at that time. He just said, I'll do my best. And Ellsberg left. Sheehan calls his wife up, all right? They go to one of these private copying places without telling Ellsberg, okay? And they go ahead and start copying the Pentagon Papers, all right? And so they haul them down to New York, again, without telling Ellsberg, all right? And like I said, there begins this big debate at the New York Times, whether to publish them or whether not to publish them, all right? Because everybody can see that it's very explosive stuff, all right? And so that debate went on for 2 months. So in other words, Ellsberg's hanging out on the wind, okay, waiting for them to make a decision. And the word gets out, of course, all right? And so Henry Kissinger, when he hears about it, says, I think I know who gave him the papers, okay? And he suspected Ellsberg because he knew Ellsberg from Rand. That's a big think tank out in Santa Monica where Ellsberg was working at, all right? And he knew that Ellsberg was violently against the war when he got back from Vietnam. So he says, I think Ellsberg worked on the project, and I think it's him. So they already suspected it's Ellsberg, all right? And so finally, the New York Times, after 3 months, starts publishing the papers. All right. And then Sheehan asked Ellsberg, because he didn't copy all of them, you know, can you give me the whole set you have? All right. And he did. But he didn't give him as much as he gave Mike Gravel, because on the I think on the first or second day that the New York Times started publishing, Ellsberg finally found a politician who would go ahead and read him into the record, Mike Gravel of Alaska. And I believe his edition was a little bit longer than what he gave the New York Times. All right. Okay. And Gravel, if I remember this correctly, he collapsed on the Senate floor.
Yeah. It's I had Mike Gravel on the show talking about that. And it's one of the reasons I always get mad. You know, nowadays people portray Mike Gravel as, oh, he's that one kooky anti-war guy. That's how the media portrays him. I mean, I think he was a very brave dude. I mean, he, you know, collapsed on the floor of the Senate reading these papers.
Gravel was a hero. I mean, he was an out-and-out hero. There's no other question about it. When Ellsberg couldn't get any politician, you know, to read the papers, Gravel did. And he went on and for like 4 hours, and he finally had physical exhaustion, okay? And he said, please, I want to admit the rest of these papers into the record. And by the way, that's how the Gravel, what they call the Gravel edition, got published as part of the congressional record that went to Beacon Press, okay? And that was published in a book form. The New York Times version, which you can still get at Amazon, okay, is I think only something like 800 pages, okay? Whereas the Gravel edition is, I think, two or three volumes. It's much more complete. Gravel was a hero. I mean, there's no other way to say that. He was a hero to do what he did. Now, what happens, of course, is what Ellsberg knew was going to happen. Kissinger and Nixon went nuts. Okay? Especially
Kissinger.
Yeah,
weren't there attempts to get his medical files at one point?
Yeah. Howard Hunt went to Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, broke in to the office with some of the Cubans, okay, and tried to steal the psychological profile of Ellsberg to smear him in the press. All right? And then, of course, Nixon, this is really hard to believe, but it's true. Nixon was so intent upon putting Ellsberg in jail that he himself supervised 5 meetings on this issue, okay, of making sure we have a case against Daniel Ellsberg. And Daniel Ellsberg went to trial, okay? And if it wasn't for this, I can't remember his name right now. He was a liberal philanthropist, passed away a few years ago. He raised the money for Ellsberg's defense, which I think was like $900,000, which this is like 1972. All right, you can imagine how much that is now. It's probably like $3 million now. All right, and so they went to trial. Russo, who helped him, Anthony Russo, who helped him copy the papers, he actually went to jail for contempt because he wouldn't rat out Ellsberg, right? And so then what got Ellsberg off was when they discovered that Howard Hunt had raided his psychiatrist's office, all right, to get these secret files, and that Nixon had offered the judge to be head of the FBI. In other words, Nixon was trying to bribe the guy, okay, to end up ruling against Ellsberg. So the trial was called off. And so that, and that's what happened. Ellsberg did go to trial, all right? See, that would have all been prevented. See, if Sheehan would not have done what he did, he would have found Gravel. Ellsberg would have found Gravel.
This is why I wanted to bring up. I also am going to have an interview with Jim Narakis up for listeners dealing with this unpublished Neil Sheehan interview. I think I sent you an article about it where, I mean, it's horrible. Sheehan basically baby faces himself, says, I'm the real hero. I told that Ellsberg, you know, I didn't steal it, Daniel. This is for the American people. It belongs to them. And he makes Ellsberg out to just be a fearful, paranoid, neurotic. Right. And I'm thinking to myself, I'd be pretty paranoid too if I was Daniel Ellsberg.
Right.
So,
yeah. I mean, what was Nixon going to do? put the New York Times in jail? Okay, of course not. Okay. But Ellsberg had taken, he had stolen classified documents, thousands of pages. So he was really on the line. If Sheehan wouldn't have done what he'd done, he would have found Gravel and he would have never had to go to trial. Okay, because of the immunity the senators have on the floor. You know, so, you know, I don't look at Sheehan as being very heroic in that light. I look at him there as essentially blowing his horse, you know, which he shouldn't have done. Now, the last thing I want to talk about with Sheehan, okay, is Mark Lane. Mark Lane is usually looked upon as being a hero of the JFK case, but he really did many, many other things. Like he wrote a book about the Martin Luther King case, okay, and he also was involved as an anti-Vietnam War protester. And he arranged something called the Winter Soldier investigation, which was after the My Lai massacre broke into the news, which I think is 68 or 69. A lot of other people who were involved in that war wanted to tell stories about similar atrocities. Okay, in case your listeners don't know, the My Lai massacre was a terrible army operation that took the lives of somewhere of over 600 people at the village, the hamlet of My Lai. Mostly all of them were women and children, civilians, all right? And it was a symbol of the U.S. military falling apart under the pressures of a war they could not win, all right? So now other people wanted to come forward and tell their stories of other atrocities that had occurred. And this was called the Winter Soldier Investigation, which Mark Lane was very instrumental in arranging. I think it was in Detroit in 1970 or 71. Well, Mark wanted to do a book to go along with this. It's called Conversations with Americans. And so a lot of these guys agreed to talk to him, but some of them wanted their names altered because they feared a military reprisal, you know, if their real names were given out. So Mark agreed to do that, but he kept the original depositions with the real names with an attorney in New York who had formerly worked for the Justice Department. And by the way, he wrote that in his book. I have the book. It's on page 17. All right. 6 weeks after the book came out, the New York Times decides to review the book. And who reviews the book? Neil Sheehan. All right. And Sheehan, in cooperation with the Pentagon, now starts attacking the book by saying, oh, ho, ho, some of these people I checked with the military and they don't even exist. So Mark Lane fabricated the interview. Any idiot can read that book and see it, like I just said, on page 17, where Mark reveals what he did, what he had to do in order to get them on paper. Now, that's not the worst part. The worst part, Sheehan went on tour to promote his article, trashing Lane and the book, and saying, I was in Vietnam for 3 years. I never saw any atrocities. All right. And so he wouldn't answer any letters by Lane. He wouldn't answer his phone calls. So finally, Mark Lane gets on a radio show with Sheehan. All right. And he says, words of the effect, you're saying that you never saw any atrocities in Vietnam. And Sheehan goes, yes, I was there for 3 years. I never saw anything, never heard anything. And so Lane says, well, what about My Lai? What about that? And Sheehan said, those are just rumors. This is 1971, okay? The pictures of My Lai had gotten out now. The pictures were in Life magazine, and the Cleveland Plain Dealer also published them. I think this was in 69, late 69, they were published. And here's Sheehan, totally in denial about what America is doing. This is what I mean. It's a perfect example of Sheehan as late as 1971 trying to prop up this lost cause, you know, and with help from the Pentagon, and smearing Mark Lane. Mark Lane, after Sheehan went on tour, the publisher withdrew the book, okay, from circulation under this constant attack by Sheehan. So Mark had to sue the publisher, right? All right, and he didn't say how much damages he got back, but he did. But that incident, if you take a look at Lane's career, that was the last book that he had published by a major publisher. I think it was Simon & Schuster. After that, he had to go with smaller houses who couldn't get him anywhere near the exposure. So Sheehan really hurt Mark Lane's career by doing that. And he would rather do that than reveal just how bad the Vietnam War had gotten by this time, which he had helped promote. So excuse me if I'm not going to write anything adulatory about Neil Sheehan, because I believe in many ways what Neil Sheehan did represented what is wrong with the MSM in this country. He was trying to cover up into the 70s a disaster that he had helped promote 10 years previously. And he was hurting a guy's career who was trying to tell the truth about what was really going on there. Anybody, by 1969, anybody could see that the U.S. military was collapsing in Vietnam. There was a famous article written by Colonel Robert Heinel, I believe in 71, in which he chronicled the up curve of fraggings in Vietnam. Should I explain what that means?
Yeah, go on.
Okay, a fragging is when a unit would get orders to do a very difficult mission the next day, knowing that there really wasn't any point to it, and they were going to suffer heavy casualties. So what they would do is throw a grenade into the commander's headquarters the night before, so they wouldn't have to go on the mission. There were many, many instances of this, which Robert Heinel chronicled. And if you take a look at his article, 69, 70, 71, they began going up and up and up. All right. So between the fraggings, between the atrocities, between the drug dealing, okay, et cetera, the American military was falling apart, okay, under the pressures of a war that they knew they could not be won. All right. And by the way, it's not just like they knew it. Nixon knew it. Nixon knew the war could not be won in 1969. But he kept the war going. You know why? Because as he told Bob Haldeman, I will not be the first president to lose a war. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine a guy saying that in the Oval Office? You know, I'm going to keep America at war during a war that I know can't be won, because I don't want to go down in history as the first American president to lose a war.
I just want to add to that. I think the reason this is so important, you know, this isn't simply about, you know, oh, we're just, you know, dumping on Neil Sheehan now that he's passed away. I think this is a really important story to look at, because ultimately, these people were considered, to quote the Halberstam book, the best and the brightest, right? These are the sort of technocrats of the establishment within media and news reporting, and within the government, and this was a complete failure. You know, someone like Nixon would say, I would rather, keep the war going than admit to technocratic failure. And I think that haunts us to this very day, because there are people on both sides of the political spectrum that look at whoever their chosen favorite politicians are and their favorite media figures are and say, these people could never fill. They're there because they're the smartest and they're the best and the brightest. But the truth is that elite failure is very real, and this is a very good example of it.
Yeah, like C. Wright Mills called it crackpot realism. Okay, you know, that's what, and this is a perfect example, crackpot realism. All right, you know, these are the people that the American public elects with the help of the media, and they kept this disastrous war going on, all right, even though they knew they couldn't win, all right, for simply a matter of their own personal prestige, which I think is ridiculous. You know,
it's CYA, a right?
What? So yeah, CYA. Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. That's what it was. And by the way, it was ridiculous for Nixon to prosecute Ellsberg. You know why? Because the Pentagon Papers ended in 1968. They stopped in 1968. In other words, there wasn't anything about Nixon in the Pentagon Papers. And therefore, how could you have any military secrets in the Pentagon Papers that would hurt the current war effort if they stopped 3 years ago? You know, it was just the whole Vietnam War thing was a terrible, terrible mistake and an epic disaster, okay, on both sides, for both the Vietnamese and Cambodians and the United States, you know. And again, excuse me if I'm not going to jump on the boat with Neil Sheehan and try to make him out to be something that he's really not. Okay, but that's just, in my view, if you read my article, I believe the facts prove that such was the case. And I'll say it again. I believe Sheehan and Halberstam were part of a bigger failure, a failure of the MSM to tell the truth about that war. All right?
I think that's a perfect note to end on. Is there anything else you want to add? And I want to say, I think, like I said, I think this article is very important because it's not really simply about Sheehan. It is about media failures that are going on to this very day. And I think this is a perfect example of that. What else is going on at Kennedy's and King's, though?
Oh, there's another article I have there about James Saxon and John Kennedy versus Wall Street, which I think is a very interesting article. It's about how Kennedy's comptroller of the currency, James Saxon, was going against the Federal Reserve and David Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan Bank, okay, in his banking policies. You know, he did not like the tight money policy of the Federal Reserve or all the regulations on banking that he thought limited credit. And by the 1962-63, he and Kennedy were opposing Douglas Dillon, the Secretary of the Treasury, and David Rockefeller, a Chase Manhattan, you know, in this struggle. And in that, I also talk about the steel crisis, which, you know, it's really weird how very few people know about. You know about it, right? Kennedy's showdown with the steel companies in 1962, where they double-crossed them, you know, and because he wanted to get a wage price agreement, you know, and they agreed to it. And then a few days later, the chairman of U.S. Steel walks into his office and says, "This is my press announcement. We're raising prices." And Kennedy just, "What? You're double-crossing me right in the Oval Office?"
I was unaware of that, yeah.
Oh, you didn't know about that? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a wonderful, and I spent a few paragraphs on it. And Kennedy calls up his brother, Bobby, who's the attorney general, and says, "What do you want to do about this?" "Well, I think this is collusion, you know, to fix prices." He goes, "Okay." So he calls up Hoover, and he says, "I want the chairman of these companies serve the subpoenas. They're going to testify before a grand jury." And it's about 11 o'clock at night. And he wakes up Hoover, and Hoover says, "Okay, the young whippersnapper wants to call me up at 11. He calls up the FBI stations in New York, and he serves the guy with subpoenas at 2 o'clock in the morning, okay? to report to a grand jury investigate. Then the next day, Kennedy goes on national television. And a speech out of Harry Truman, he says, "I, along with I think everybody else, will be outraged that a set of plutocratic steel executives would put their interests above the interests of 180 million people. okay, in their pursuit of profit, okay? It's wonderful. And I wrote in there, I go, if anybody can tell me where a president ever went on national television and talked about this, the common good versus big business like Kennedy did, I'd like to know, okay? I'd like to know when it happened. So that's a part of that article, okay? There was a real battle going on.
You also have an upcoming article from, I think, Jeff Carter on MLK and FBI, that
yes.
documentary?
There's a new okay. film out, okay, about MLK, FBI, which you can get online, all right, which I saw the other day. And Jeff Carter is going to be reviewing that for us. We cover JFK, RFK, King, and Malcolm X. I believe those are the four assassinations of the 60s that completely did a somersault on where America was headed at that time. I was actually around back then, okay? So I understand the kind of country it was back then. And it's not anywhere near. I mean, can you, it's beyond imagining to think what happened on January 6th could have happened in 1964 or 65 or 61, et cetera. That's just out of this world.
I was going to ask you that too, and then I promised to let you go since we went over time. What are your thoughts on what happened at the Capitol and now post that with, Biden's inauguration?
I was shocked. Here I am. I'm watching this on my computer screen. I said, is this really real? And I started emailing people. I go, are you watching what's going on here? And so I went out and bought a 12-pack. I was trying to dull my senses at what I was watching. It was just so, surreal, to see a crowd of 8,000 people trying to break into the Capitol building, thinking that they could overthrow the election for Trump. And, that's only half the story, because that morning there were several speeches near the White House that inspired that crowd, that provoked that crowd. The legal term is inciting the crowd to do what they did, And then for them to break through the police force, and actually start searching for people. Where's Mike Pence? Where's Pelosi? Okay. And our representatives are hiding in a secure room, not knowing who's going to be able to break down the door. I mean, that was just, wow. I mean, as we always try to say, we're not a banana republic. What was that?
I'm pretty sure all the countries that we've been, throwing criticism at for a long time looked at us and were like, ah, yeah, you're a democracy.
Wasn't that ironic? Okay.
Yeah.
And you're telling us how to run our country, and this is what's happening to you. Okay. I mean, Putin must have been laughing. He probably fell off his chair. Okay.
Well, I was going to say too, I also brought it up because I think one of the great things about Kennedy's and King is, you do believe there was a conspiracy in the assassinations of the 60s. But you've also done a lot of really great debunking work. And I think in ways you guys are the antidote to the craziness of things like QAnon.
Yes. Yeah. See, this is one of the things that really puzzles me. Stephen Gillon, who's an establishment historian, all right, at the University of Oklahoma, when I think it was back in November, tried to say Trump's theorizing about this and the whole QAnon movement started with Mark Lane. And I just about fell off my chair when I read that. The idea that Mark Lane would be backing Trump's attempt to overthrow the election and would believe in this pedophile ring in Washington that Trump is trying to expose, I mean, that's beyond ludicrous.
Yeah, and Mark was like a left liberal, as I understand it.
Yeah, and he was pro-government. These guys are anti-government, pro-gun, And so Mark Lane would have been on the other side of all this. And I said, Is Golan really serious? Doesn't he really know? He's an historian. This all began back in the 50s with the Alger Hiss case, the giant communist conspiracy was exasperated.
The John Birchers, the McCarthyites. Right.
McCarthy and the John Birch Society. That's, and the whole Barry Goldwater thing. That's where this all came from.
Yeah, it doesn't come from, I think, Mark Lane or, people reading Mae Brussel.
You know, that's, I mean, the whole right-wing conspiracy thing goes back, it predates Mark Lane. It goes back to the 50s. It predates it by 10 years at least. And that's where these people, they're descendants of that kind of a thing. See, Golan did this documentary at the 50th. On the show were Gary Mack and Dale Myers. Okay. So you know what kind of show it was. It was essentially a Warren Commission backing Oswald did it program that Golan was a producer of, and he was the main talking head. So that's what he was doing, you know. And see, these guys who participate in the cover-up, the JFK cover-up, always have to get back at the people who don't buy them. And so this is what his way of doing it. He's also one of the people I went after in my open letter on JFK and civil rights, okay, which that's another article up at kennedysandking.com. And the establishment view of this is so unlike what the real record was. So I had to write these guys, Frederick Logaval, Joe Scarborough, Van Jones, Stephen Golan, and a couple of other people. And I said, you're trying to make LBJ a hero on civil rights and Kennedy didn't do anything. I go, that's exactly wrong. Okay. For 20 years, LBJ was in Congress and the Senate. Every single civil rights bill that went up to the Hill, he was against. Four times, he voted against civil rights. He only changed his mind in 1957 because he was thinking of running for the presidency. And he had seen what happened to Richard Russell, the senator from Georgia, who was anti-civil rights. Russell couldn't get out of the South as a national candidate. And Johnson didn't want that to happen to him. And then at the same time, Eisenhower and Nixon sent a very mild Civil Rights Commission bill to the Senate. They had no interest in civil rights. Eisenhower actually tried to advise Earl Warren of voting against the Brown versus Board decision, which struck down in segregation in the South. What they were trying to do was split the Democratic Party between the Northern liberals and the Southern conservatives, which eventually did happen, of course. We know that. Okay, but that's what they were trying to do back in 57. So LBJ stage managed that bill to the point where it meant next to nothing almost. Kennedy didn't even want to vote for the bill because he thought it was too weak. You know, Johnson had to send an assistant up to make sure, talk him into voting for it. Then once Kennedy got into office, as I write in that article, my God, it was like an electric giant wave went through the South for 3 years because him and his brother were doing so many things, you know, culminating in the 1963 Civil Rights Bill. So that's what you get from the MSM. It's not enough for them to cover up Kennedy's assassination, which they did. But with people like Neil Sheehan and people like Stephen Golan, they have to cover up who the guy was. And they both work together, you know, they're interlocking. Because if you cover up the assassination, then, well, he wasn't really that good of a president anyway. So why are we spending all this energy talking about it?
And then there's even all the character assassinations that people.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't like, even like that.
I'll just say real quick. It's like when you read any book that Roger Stone has ever written claiming that he wants to, you know, expose the people behind the Kennedy assassination. And half the time he's talking about, oh, Kennedy was using speed prescribed to him by his doctor. And you can tell he just wants to destroy Kennedy.
Right. You know? Yeah. And we have a whole long article about the whole Marilyn Monroe thing at Kennedy's and King, which is it's a bunch of paper mache also. Okay. Well, so thank you for letting me promote my site. Okay. And if you're really interested in digging beneath the surface, You know, I'm not saying this to brag or anything, but I really do believe that KennedysandKing.com is a really good place to start about what really happened to this country in the 60s.
Well, that does it for the first part of this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jim DiEugenio of Kennedys and King. In the next part of this two-part show, we'll be hearing from Jim Narakis of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting on a story published after Neil Sheehan's death, which attempts to rewrite the story of the Pentagon Papers, making Sheehan the hero and the whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg out to be merely a fearful neurotic. Needless to say, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting took issue with the Times story that was published shortly after Neil Sheehan's passing. But before we get to that, producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. If you'd like, you can also drop me a line with your thoughts on the first part of this two-parter Parallax Views examination of the late New York Times reporter Neil Sheehan by contacting me on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Also, I failed to note a moment ago when talking about the Patreon that there is a $1 tier and $5 tier, and that any amount will help this show keep going. So with that in mind, patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. Hope you'll be listening to part two of this Parallax Views two-parter. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.